Thank you very much, dear friends, journalists, for coming to this press conference at the conclusion of the summit we started on Monday morning. I would just like to say that you are partners in this fight against hunger. Your information, your communication with the public opinion, all this is as important as the work we do, because the fight against hunger is first battle to have the support of the people, and every person could make a difference. I therefore would like to express my gratitude to you for having come and having followed all the different events related to this summit. I think it's very important first to realize that this summit is a conclusion of a long process. We first started raising the idea of a summit at World Food Day in October 2008 in New York, when we had the pleasure of the participation of former President Clinton. And there already I said we have to be careful. The focus now is on the economic and financial crisis, but we still have the food crisis, and this economic and financial situation would worsen the situation of the hungry around the world. You have seen that this is exactly what happened, because in 2009 alone, the number of hungry people increased by 105 million. Therefore, I said, unless we get an important event that raises awareness and attracts the media, you, we will start forgetting completely about this problem, which is very serious. And naturally, we needed an event that would allow the different governments to discuss the structural issues. You know that we had a high-level conference, not a summit, in June last year. But I'm sure you would remember that this high-level conference was on world food security, the challenges of bioenergy and climate change. It's only because of the riots in 2007-2008, with all the implications on world peace and stability. It's certainly because the impact this time was not only in developing countries, but in developed countries, where we had inflation, where we had protests. Even in Italy here, women protested because of the costs, high cost of pasta. And we, therefore, were faced with a situation in which countries that had resources to buy on the world market could not buy because there was no food due to the restrictive measures being taken by some countries who normally would be exporting food. But because of the high internal prices, there was a pressure, a political pressure on them. And naturally, they had difficulty justifying that they were exporting when in their own countries people were having difficulty accessing food. And the accumulation of those restrictive measures led to a situation that did worsen. So because the problem was not only a problem of developing countries, we had great interest on the part of developed countries. Now, coming back to October 2008, we started making consultations and we took the issue to the conference of FAO in November and said, you know, we have to be careful if we do not start the process of calling a summit that would look at long-term issues, structural issues, not react to a crisis, as was the case in June 2008 conference, then we might have very serious problems in the future. Well, to address structural issues, we thought we needed to have a meeting of the best experts in the world on the different aspects, on the different dimensions. And that's why we had this forum on how to feed the world in 2050. 2050 horizon, naturally, because by then world population will increase from 6.6 billion to 9.1 billion. And already all our projections had shown that to feed the world by then, we would need to increase world production by 70% and in developing countries by 100%. We therefore thought that we needed to address different facets of this challenge. And in discussing the different issues, the experts came to the conclusion that 10 areas had to be addressed and the analysis and conclusions be deepened. First, global concept, feeding the world 2050 with essentially the objective of looking at interaction interfaces of different issues. Second, the investment imperative. We move from 17% of ODA to agriculture stricto sensu, but if we add forestry, fisheries, lato sensu, it was 19%, down to 3.8% in 2006, and slightly up to 5% now. So that was one of the first problems. What do we do? There's no way we can solve the problem of food security. There's no way we can double food production in developing countries if there are no resources invested in agriculture for infrastructure in particular, but for accessing inputs, etc. The third issue, which led to quite a number of controversies, in particular in relation to land, was the question of foreign direct investment. And you are aware of a number of articles, Le Monde, Financial Times, etc., on this issue. Then we thought it was important to address the issue of food security and the financial crisis. What are the interrelations and interactions? A fifth area of focus, global governance and food security. Because there are so many institutions that naturally impact on world food security through their actions. It's not FAO alone, I think I compared the data that the annual budget of FAO is $500 million. If we divide it by the number of hungry people, it's $0.5 million. And if we look at the income of a poor person, it's $2 per day, therefore $730. So it's certainly not $0.5 per day that will change the situation of somebody who, even poor, has $730 per year. Therefore, the players, financial players, are not in FAO. They are somewhere else. They are in the World Bank. They are in the regional development banks, African, Asian, Inter-American, Islamic Development Bank, etc. They are in the framework of the European Union with the European Development Fund, etc., etc. We therefore thought it was important to discuss how to involve them. You know, what is happening in WTO has an impact on world food security, and naturally the farmers' organizations, civil society, etc. All those are players. How to get a governance that takes into consideration all those partners with a view to get some coherence in what they are doing in relation to the objective set, naturally that also was a very important issue. Then the sixth issue was support to farmers. No. It's reasonable to make sure that farmers get an income that is comparable to the income of workers in secondary and tertiary sector. Otherwise, why would they stay in farm? But if they go, you know, who will produce the food for 9.2 billion? But should we continue to do it in a way that is distorting, that creates a situation of unfair competition to developing countries, and that doesn't also very much help the developed country small farmers? We have seen them protesting in the street, throwing their milk in the fields, etc. Therefore, something's wrong with the system. So how to help farmers by ensuring that it is not done by favoring a group to the expense of the other? Then a seventh point, the contribution of technology to agricultural development, research, extension, resistant varieties that will deal with stress, with drought, in particular in the framework of climate change, with salinity or whatever. We therefore needed to bring the research organizations together to discuss those. Then, naturally, the challenges of climate change and bioenergy, you know, came back again as an important issue. But also the issue of transboundary animal and plant pests and diseases. And that's why my speech at the summit focused on that. Production is good. Productivity is good. But if you produce and then the locusts come and eat it, or if you have disease of animals like avian flu, therefore not only you have a risk for animals, you have a risk for human beings. And then there are many of those who are being, in many cases, exacerbated by climate change. Because some diseases that didn't exist in some areas now do exist because temperature has changed. And the tenth point is sub-Saharan Africa, which is really a great challenge because of the disease, the great human tragedy of the largest percentage of hungry in the world. And we prepared a synthesis document with all the conclusions called Feeding the World and Eradicating Hunger. So it was also important to demonstrate that we are not in a situation that is hopeless. Because there are countries that are successful, that are fighting hunger. Now, in all the continent, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. And that's why we produce a document called Pathway to Success. You know, clearly explaining those experiences and those successes. And you know, just a few days before the summit, we organized a meeting of the parliaments in cooperation with the Interparliamentary Union and with the support of the Italian Parliament, because it's parliaments who are voting the budgets of governments, and parliaments are also expected to control the work, the actions, and the results of government. We also organized a meeting with the private sector to discuss foreign direct investment, code of conduct on such type of investment. And last but not least, we supported, but again, it was their own meeting, the civil society and NGO in particular, thanks to the backing of the mayor of Rome. And at the summit itself, we saw beyond speeches explaining the specific situation, views and concerns and proposal of solutions of individual delegations, we needed to have round table to focus on critical issues. And four round tables were organized. Minimizing the negative impact of the food, economic, and financial crisis on world food security. Implementation of the reform of global governance on food security. Climate change adaptation and mitigation challenges for agriculture and food security. And then measure to enhance global food security, rural development, smallholder farmers, and trade considerations. So all this work, you know, went on, and I don't want to detail all the summits we had to attend to get support in the Arab League, in Africa, in Latin America, etc. These 3 days meeting have been the conclusion of a whole year of activities, studies, consultation, actions, etc., to raise awareness on the situation of 1 billion hungry people and to try to arrive at some agreements on how to deal with the issue. I think I better stop there, but I thought it was important to make the history of the process and also to give the magnitude of the approach to this issue and not focus only on the 3 days meeting. So I'm at your disposal with the assistance.
Thank you, Derek Jurin, for this comprehensive overview of the summit preparations and the summit itself. Would like to open the floor for the Q&A segment. Yes, please.
Okay. Je suis Mohamed Ba de Radio Radicale en Italie. Vous m'entendez, Monsieur Diouf? Donc, je voulais tout juste savoir si vous êtes satisfait de cette conférence. Autrement dit, agriculture et changement climatique presque vont ensemble ces derniers temps. Dans quelques semaines, la conférence de Copenhague. Comment comptez-vous défendre la situation de l'Afrique qui, d'autre part, est victime de cette situation? Merci.
Merci bien. Ma réponse est le verre à moitié vide ou le verre à moitié plein. Naturellement, je suis heureux de ce que, pour un sommet de la FAO, qui a 192 nations membres plus l'Union européenne, nous ayons eu 182 États membres représentés ici. Naturellement, j'aurais espéré avoir dans un sommet de chefs d'État et de gouvernement tous les pays représentés au niveau de leurs chefs d'État et de gouvernement, et pas seulement pour des raisons à caractère protocolaire, non. C'est tout simplement parce que nous sommes convaincus que les problèmes de l'agriculture dépassent les ministres de l'agriculture. Les ministres de l'agriculture, je le dis souvent, ont les problèmes de l'agriculture, ils n'ont pas les solutions. Financement de l'agriculture n'est pas décidé par les ministres de l'agriculture. Le commerce agricole, importation, exportation, ce n'est pas décidé par les ministres de l'Agriculture. Et naturellement, les négociations internationales sur le commerce agricole sont souvent conduites par les ministres du commerce. Les négociations avec les bailleurs de fonds bilatéraux et multilatéraux sont en général réalisées par les ministres de la coopération ou des affaires étrangères, pas les ministres de l'agriculture. Les infrastructures, routes, etc., qui ont un impact sur la productivité, la production agricole, ce ne sont pas les ministres de l'agriculture. Et je peux continuer. Et donc, si nous n'avons pas les chefs d'État ou de gouvernement qui ont autorité sur tous les ministres, qui peuvent coordonner l'action pour venir discuter de ces questions, de l'aide au développement, etc., je pense que nous passons à côté du problème puisque nous réduisons la question à sa dimension purement technique, alors que c'est une dimension économique, c'est une dimension sociale, c'est une dimension financière, je dirais même une dimension culturelle. Parce que l'agriculture et la culture, comme disait quelqu'un, entre les deux, il y a juste un champ. Vous mettrez T ou MPS, MP, mais enfin, voilà ce que disait un de mes amis. Donc, c'est pour ça que nous souhaitions avoir les chefs d'État de tous les pays. Bon, on en a eu 60. Ce n'est pas mal. Et je dois ajouter, on a eu 191 ministres. Y compris des ministres des Affaires étrangères, en plus de ministres de l'Agriculture, etc. Et il y a eu 3646 délégués à cette réunion. Donc, selon que vous regardiez ce côté ou l'absence des membres du G8, sauf l'Italie, naturellement, vous pouvez porter des jugements différents. Mais je disais à quelqu'un qui me posait la question, mais moi, je n'ai pas convoqué un sommet du G8. J'ai convoqué un sommet des 192 nations membres de l'organisation pour parler des problèmes de la sécurité alimentaire du monde qui touche chacun de ces pays. Voilà ce que je peux dire sur la satisfaction ou l'insatisfaction. Naturellement, changement climatique, nous tous, nous voyons ce qui se passe aujourd'hui. En Afrique, quel est le problème? Alors, la sécheresse sur la corne de l'Afrique, Kenya, Somalie, Éthiopie, Érythrée, Djibouti. Dans le même temps, nous avons les inondations en Afrique de l'Ouest, Sénégal, Mali, Burkina Faso, etc., etc. Je peux continuer. Et nous avons la sécheresse en Inde. S'il n'y avait pas eu la politique sage du gouvernement indien qui avait constitué des stocks, on serait déjà dans la situation de 2007-2008. Parce que ce sont les stocks qui ont permis d'amortir l'impact de la sécheresse en Inde. Nous avons la sécheresse dans un des plus grands pays exportateurs de céréales, en Argentine. Nous avons dans le même temps les inondations. Les inondations. Et les inondations, nous les avons aussi en Amérique latine. Vous avez vu ce qui s'est passé récemment au Salvador. Avant le Salvador, vous avez vu le Guatemala qui a déclaré un état de calamité nationale. Et je peux continuer avec tous ces phénomènes climatiques qui ont un impact direct sur l'offre de produits agricoles, la capacité productive. Et tout cela, naturellement, complique la recherche de solutions au problème de la sécurité alimentaire. Alors, bon, qu'est-ce que je souhaite pour l'Afrique ? C'est qu'on aide l'Afrique à maîtriser l'eau d'abord. Nous avons travaillé avec les ministres africains de l'eau, de l'énergie et de l'agriculture pour préparer plus de 1000 projets dans 53 pays, pays par pays, avec les cadres de ces pays et leurs ministres, pour avoir des programmes à court terme dans les villages de collecte d'eau et de petits ouvrages d'irrigation, puits, etc. Des programmes à moyen terme qui portent essentiellement sur la réhabilitation des grands aménagements qui existent maintenant mais qui ne fonctionnent pas bien dans plusieurs pays, soit pour des raisons techniques, d'infrastructures ou de gestion. Et à plus long terme, l'aménagement des bassins fluviaux et les transferts interbassins, notamment pour régler des problèmes comme ceux du bassin du lac Tchad, qui, en une quarantaine d'années, a perdu 90% de sa superficie. Bon, ce programme est un programme avec un portefeuille de 65 milliards de dollars de projets. J'espère que la Réunion va permettre de mobiliser des ressources pour réaliser ces programmes de maîtrise de l'eau pour le continent africain. Naturellement, il y a d'autres choses, mais je me limite pour le moment à ça. Oui, c'est de ça que je dis. Je dis, c'est ce que j'attends que Copenhague fasse pour l'Afrique. Et j'ai dit, je ne parle que de ça, parce qu'il y a d'autres problèmes. Il y a les forêts, il y a, nous sommes dans un programme conjoint avec le PNUE, avec le PNUD, sur les problèmes de déforestation et de dégradation forestière, les mécanismes de financement pour empêcher que les pays ne coupent leurs forêts. Enfin, on peut passer toute la journée ici à parler de ça.
Thank you. Jeff Tanzi, BBC Radio 4 Food Programme. Last Saturday, you said at the Civil Society Forum, you know summits don't solve all problems and governments tend to look for the lowest common denominator. I wondered which problem specifically this summit has solved and which denominator you think governments have reached, especially if we think back to 1974 and the First World Food Conference, which I was around for, and the things that were said that would have been done then, which if they had been, we might not have been where we are now.
No, I believe first we have to be very realistic. The responsibility for ensuring food security, agriculture and rural development is the responsibility of each government and its people. It's not the responsibility of FAO, and certainly not the responsibility of a summit. A summit doesn't have land, a summit doesn't have farmers, a summit doesn't have budget to invest. A summit is a framework for discussion, debate, to arrive at consensus solutions in the face of common challenges at global level. That's what it is, and that's what it does. And one of the responsibilities of FAO, clearly stated in its constitution, is to offer a forum for debate of issues that have an impact on world food security. That's what we did. Once a summit has agreed on something, and we agreed by consensus on a declaration with its achievements and its limitations, that's why I say every international negotiation I have witnessed has led to a common, a smallest common denominator. Because if there is one who says no, then how can you agree? And that one will be ready to agree on what it considers acceptable at that level. That's already, by the way, what is happening with the climate change negotiations. Some are saying, you know, we should put this level, we should provide the fund, it should be immediately. Others are saying the level of emission should be at these and that, et cetera. And that what happened in every negotiation in the world among governments. And that's what blocked the negotiation of WTO. How many years have we been waiting since Doha? So I don't think there's anything particular in this summit in relation to other summits. I think that we have agreed on important things. One, to reverse the trend of investment in agriculture in relation to ODA. I think we agreed on total eradication of hunger. Up till now, we were talking of cutting by half, which meant accepting that the other half will continue to be hungry. That's what was agreed in 1996 FAO Summit and also in the Millennium Development Goals, number one. Third thing, we have decided to get a more coherent governance system in which we will be bringing all the different partners I mentioned in my introduction. Well, I think that's quite some progress. Again, if it is implemented, you know, because this is, again, so far a declaration, and that's all we can do. We cannot implement in a summit. But at the same time, I have said, and candidly, I repeat it, that I would have wished, if it depended on me, and unfortunately it didn't depend on me, that this be strengthened with clear quantitative targets and clear also dates for achieving such quantitative targets. So I think, yes, we made progress. But as one would expect, it didn't go as far as a head of FAO, whose responsibility is to promote food security, would have wished to see. But we have also to recognize, you know, what's the responsibility of each of the parties. This is my job. I proposed to my governing bodies to call a summit, which they approved in June. And as I mentioned, they approve and say, go and get the money, don't use the budget. I had to go and get $2.5 million from Saudi Arabia to finance it. And then we organized the meeting, and as I say, we got a lot of attendance, and we got a unanimously agreed declaration. Now, what happened in other important summits like the G8, do they implement anything? They make commitments. You know, even the G8 in L'Aquila, you know, agreed to have mobilized within 3 years, starting with 2009, $20 to $22 billion. We'll have to see the money. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The young lady over there, please.
Srivastava de Radio-Canada de Montréal. Monsieur Diouf, je veux saluer le travail que vous avez fait. Vous avez bien récupéré, semble-t-il, de votre grève de la faim. J'aimerais revenir sur ce que vous venez d'aborder. J'aimerais vous entendre davantage sur ce que vous auriez souhaité avoir dans cette déclaration. Et vous m'avez ouvert la porte, vous avez évoqué également le fait que l'Arabie saoudite finance la tenue de ce sommet. Or, ce matin même, je parlais avec le rapporteur spécial de l'ONU, Olivier de Schutter, sur les pratiques d'investissement qui ne sont pas toujours responsables de la part de l'Arabie saoudite lorsqu'ils vont faire ce que certains appellent l'accaparement des terres ou d'autres de l'agriculture délocalisée. Est-ce que ce n'est pas un peu ironique que ce soit eux qui financent la tenue de ce sommet où on veut baliser ces pratiques? Je vous remercie.
Merci bien. En ce qui concerne les objectifs, ils étaient dans le document que nous avons préparé et que nous avons envoyé non seulement aux ambassadeurs et représentants permanents auprès de la FAO, mais nous avons veillé. C'était un peu à la limite des procédures habituelles. Mais j'ai veillé personnellement à envoyer ce document à chaque ministre des Affaires étrangères et à chaque ministre de l'Agriculture des pays membres en informant le chef de l'État et le chef de gouvernement du fait que j'avais envoyé ce document. Parce que je voulais être sûr que tout le monde l'ait et que ce ne soit pas seulement bloqué quelque part dans les procédures et dans les circuits administratifs. Premièrement, j'avais proposé qu'au-delà de la simple déclaration de l'éradication de la faim dans le monde, qu'on dise quand. Et j'ai proposé 2025. Je n'ai pas proposé 2025 comme ça, en l'air. J'ai dit, d'abord, les États membres ont signé, dans le cadre de la FAO, les lignes directrices pour le droit à l'alimentation. Ils l'ont signé tous, ils l'ont approuvé tous. On ne peut pas approuver une chose et après dire on ne fait pas. Pourquoi 2025? Tout simplement parce que dans le cadre du sommet ibéro-américain, et si ma mémoire est bonne, c'était en décembre 2006, les chefs d'État de l'Amérique latine, centre, sud, plus l'Espagne et le Portugal, plus naturellement des pays latins des Caraïbes comme Saint-Domingue, comme Cuba, etc., ont approuvé un programme qui s'appelle Amérique latine sans faim, AIM, 2025, au niveau de leur chef d'État et de gouvernement. Ensuite, ce document a été entériné lors du sommet de ces chefs d'État avec d'Amérique latine, sans cette fois-ci l'Espagne et le Portugal, lors de leur sommet avec les pays Caraïbes, à Salvador de Bahia, au Brésil. Et donc, c'est devenu un document Amérique latine et Caraïbes sans faim 2025. J'ai pensé, peut-être trop simplement, que ce qu'on avait approuvé avec les chefs d'État et de gouvernement de toute l'Amérique latine et des Caraïbes, et avec l'Espagne et avec le Portugal, on pouvait avoir cet objectif pour le reste du monde. Voilà, moi, c'est la logique de ce que j'ai proposé. Bah, la logique politique et la logique des intérêts et la logique de la diplomatie, c'est autre chose. Bon, enfin, moi, j'essaie d'être rationnel sur ce que je propose. Maintenant, l'objectif, l'autre objectif quantitatif, c'est la part de l'aide au développement qui devrait aller à l'agriculture. Là aussi, j'ai essayé d'être rationnel. Je me suis dit, mais pour faire la révolution verte en Asie et en Amérique latine dans les années 60-70, à l'époque, on ne citait pas l'Afrique parce que l'Afrique exportait. C'est les autres pays qui avaient faim. Ça, on semble l'oublier aussi. On a dû mettre entre 16 et 19% de l'aide au développement dans l'agriculture, de l'aide officielle au développement, pour financer les infrastructures, l'irrigation, le drainage, les moyens de stockage, les routes rurales, les centres de multiplication de semences, les centres de production d'engrais, de pesticides, etc., etc., les marchés et tout. À l'époque, on avait 830 millions de personnes qui ont faim dans le monde. On est descendu à 3,8%, avec comme conséquence que le nombre de personnes qui ont faim a maintenant atteint 1 milliard. J'ai pensé que c'était du bon sens de dire, mais pourquoi on ne retourne pas à ce niveau pour pouvoir financer les mêmes choses qui seront nécessaires pour assurer l'investissement. Moi, je ne discute pas du niveau de l'aide au développement. Ce niveau a été fixé dans le cadre des négociations de Monterrey et récemment de Doha. J'ai donc dit, dans ce que vous avez décidé de fixer comme niveau de l'aide, consacrer ces 17% à la sécurité alimentaire du monde pour non seulement nourrir 1 milliard de personnes qui ont faim, mais pouvoir doubler la production pour une population qui va atteindre 9 milliards. Personnellement, en tout cas, ce qu'on nous a appris en cartésianisme, moi, je pense que ça ne souffre pas de discussion. Et il faut avoir en plus à l'esprit que 70% des pauvres du monde sont en milieu rural et que leur source principale de revenus, d'emploi et d'autoconsommation alimentaire, c'est l'activité agricole. Est-ce irrationnel de leur donner 17% de l'aide au développement à 70% des pauvres du monde? Voilà, moi, c'est ce que j'ai proposé. Maintenant, la question de l'accaparement des terres, de la Saoudite, etc., moi, je ne porte pas de jugement individuel sur les pays et leurs gouvernements. Chaque gouvernement est souverain, il fait ce qu'il fait, il le fait avec d'autres gouvernements souverains, ça, c'est leur problème. Moi, ce que j'ai dit, et j'ai été le premier, je dis bien le premier à le dire dans un article dans Le Monde et avec des reprises d'une partie de cette opide dans Financial Times, c'est qu'il y avait des risques à poursuivre certaines pratiques en matière d'investissement dans l'agriculture dans certains pays. J'ai dit que si on ne fait pas attention, on va avoir non seulement des révoltes, ceux qui investissent eux-mêmes vont perdre leur argent, et en fin de compte, on risque de créer un problème avec l'investissement dont on a pourtant besoin. Parce qu'on ne peut pas doubler la production alimentaire dans les pays en voie de développement sans investissement privé. Et j'ai dit que les premières actions que nous voyons dans certains pays s'apparentaient du néo-pacte colonial. Et pour ne pas rester dans les déclarations, nous avons mené une étude approfondie avec le FIDA et d'autres partenaires pour montrer des cas concrets dans plusieurs pays. Et ce n'est pas seulement en Afrique. La preuve, c'est que les deux révoltes qui ont entraîné des changements des accords signés se sont déroulées, une en Afrique, mais l'autre en Amérique latine. Je ne veux pas entrer dans le détail, parce que ce sont mes États membres, je ne veux pas commencer à les citer. Mais enfin, vous êtes des journalistes, vous savez très bien de qui je parle et comment ça s'est passé, où ça s'est passé. Voilà, merci.
Over there, please.
Good afternoon, I'm Sonia Filippazzi from Radio Rai. Radio Rai, Sonia Filippazzi. during the summit from some delegation and the forum of civil society, many addressed the issue of reinforcing FAO's role and efficiency. My question is, will this have an impact?
Excuse me,
yes.
I'm having
Shall I start again?
I think I took the wrong... Repeat.
During the forum from delegations, but also the forum of civil societies, many addressed the issue of, on one side, strengthening FAO's role and activities and coordination, but also its efficiency. My question is, will this have an impact on the FAO's conference, which is starting now, in particular on the project of reform, which is the situation of this project?
I wish I could tell you what will happen at the end of the conference. But what is sure is that as far as the governance issue is concerned, there is an agreement on strengthening the Committee on Food Security, which is in the framework of the basic text of FAO. There has been long negotiation, different ideas, different interests, different views, but in the end, I think what prevailed was common sense. One, there is already a Committee on Food Security. And when I read comments or hear views, one principle is don't duplicate, don't create new mechanisms, and so on. Therefore, I didn't know why some wanted to create new mechanisms. Secondly, that mechanism is, because it's in the framework of the basic text, the result of a process of approval by governments and ratification by parliaments. And therefore, to be changed, there is a need for two-third majority. I sincerely never understood how some could imagine that they will find two-third majority to do what they wanted to do. Now, the other point that I think is important is that this Committee on Food Security is made of the member nations of FAO and the member state of the UN General Assembly. Therefore, one, is truly universal, and two, it is intergovernmental because made of sovereign countries who take decisions regarding what they want to do in their countries. Naturally, we said that this committee has its weaknesses. And if we want it really to be effective, we should correct those weaknesses, therefore reform the committee. In what way? First, we said that we need to have all the partners on board. WTO, World Bank, financial institutions, because everything they do has an impact on world food security. We said there are other partners, private sector, civil society, NGOs, who should come and discuss the issues in that framework. We also said that the Committee on Food Security, to be credible, must meet at a level high enough for decisions to be taken. If we send low-level delegations, as we have done over the last years, they commit who? Nobody. And their actions are not followed by anything. And we also said, okay, in FAO we have well-structured scientific committees, but they are sectoral. In forest, we have one of the best committees. You know, in economic and social, yes. In agriculture, in fisheries, etc. And they report to the council. They don't report to the Committee on Food Security. Maybe we need a more multidisciplinary scientific body that provides the basis, the scientific basis for decisions to be made by the Committee on Food Security. Therefore, there will be credibility. And that is why the principle of a high-level panel of experts was accepted, and we're in the process of putting it in place. There are consultations, we wrote to government, proposals have been made, and the process is in motion. These are some of the things that we discussed, we addressed, and I expect that as it was unanimously, or even not to say unanimously, at least by consensus, agreed, I expect that it will be endorsed in the framework of the conference. Thank you.
I have a question here, and then Khafir.
Monsieur le directeur général, c'est Madiambal Diagne du journal Le Quotidien au Sénégal. En marge du sommet de la FAO, vous avez eu des rencontres bilatérales avec certains chefs de délégation, notamment des chefs d'État et de gouvernement. Peut-on savoir si les discussions bilatérales que vous avez eues avec ces personnalités vous autorisent à plus d'espoir par rapport à la mise en œuvre des conclusions de ce sommet?
Oui, je dois dire chaque jour, j'ai reçu jusqu'à 9h30, 10h, toutes les demi-heures, les différentes délégations, et je vais continuer ce soir. Et c'est encore un des éléments positifs des sommets auxquels on ne pense pas. Un sommet, ce n'est pas seulement venir faire des discours en plénière. Au cours des sommets, les délégations se rencontrent, discutent de leur coopération bilatérale dans le cadre de l'agriculture, de la sécurité alimentaire, la coopération technique, sud-sud, nord-sud, etc. Et il y a des réunions tout le temps. Et ça, c'est aussi une opportunité en un seul endroit, sans avoir à voyager dans le monde entier, d'avoir 60 chefs d'État, d'avoir 191 ministres et de pouvoir discuter. Y compris des questions qui touchent la coopération directe avec la FAO dans ces différents pays. Je dois dire que ce qui m'encourage, c'est que j'ai eu des discussions très franches avec les chefs d'État. Moi, je dois dire que, je ne nommerai pas lequel, un jour, je suis allez, un chef d'État qui venait d'être élu m'a reçu et bon, j'ai donné mon point de vue. Quand j'ai fini, il s'est tourné vers moi, il m'a dit, mais monsieur Diouf, est-ce que c'est comme ça que vous parlez avec tous les chefs d'État? J'ai dit oui, parce que si je ne peux pas me permettre de vous parler franchement des questions que vous m'avez confiées dans le cadre des responsabilités pour lesquelles vous m'avez élu, je ne vois pas qui va vous le dire. Et il m'a dit, je dois dire que c'est assez inhabituel. Bon, j'ai parlé très franchement avec ces chefs d'État. Je leur ai dit, écoutez, nous sommes là pour vous aider, nous allons vous soutenir. Mais sincèrement, si vous n'assumez pas vous-même directement les responsabilités de la sécurité alimentaire Et au lieu de les confier seulement au ministre de l'Agriculture, qui certes sont de bonne volonté, ils défendent l'agriculture, mais pour les raisons que j'ai expliquées, ils n'en ont pas tous les moyens. Si vous ne prenez pas vos responsabilités pour qu'il y ait ces réunions, au moins deux fois dans l'année, sous votre responsabilité personnelle, avant la campagne et après la campagne, pour voir si les engagements ont été tenus. Je pense que vous avez beau donner tous les ordres, il n'y aura pas de résultats. Et je pense qu'en général, tous étaient d'accord. Le deuxième point, c'est que, certes, nous sommes en train de tout faire pour mobiliser des ressources internationales. Mais il faut commencer par les ressources nationales des budgets. Si les pays eux-mêmes qui ont des personnes qui ont faim ne donnent pas la priorité à l'agriculture, au nom de quoi ils vont aller voir des pays développés et leur dire « moi, je ne paie même pas mon argent dans le secteur, mais vous venez y mettre votre argent ». Au nom de quoi? Ça, je leur ai dit. Je dois dire aussi, pour être honnête, que beaucoup sont déjà conscients de ces questions et ont déjà engagé des programmes sur lesquels nous travaillons avec eux, notamment les programmes nationaux de sécurité alimentaire, les programmes d'investissement dans l'eau dont je viens de parler, les programmes de distribution de semences, on a mis pour 400 millions de dollars, etc. Bon. Donc, je crois que petit à petit, on y arrive. Et surtout, je crois que depuis qu'il y a eu les émeutes et les morts et l'instabilité dans certains pays au niveau des gouvernements, je pense qu'il y a une plus grande prise de conscience des risques que l'on prend en ne réglant pas les problèmes de la sécurité alimentaire d'une manière structurelle. Merci.
Javier Blas.
Thank you, Javier Blas, Financial Times. A couple of questions, very quick, if I may, Mr. Director General. The first one is the government of Norway has announced that it's cancelling FAO partnership program and is doing so in protest for your leadership or lack of your leadership. And they said that the reason is that the FAO has not been able to do his reform. So I was wondering if you have a comment on that. And my second question is, there has been a lot of criticism on FAO leadership on the backdrop of this conference. It's a year on your mandate, it's the last year of your mandate next year. So I was wondering if you plan to stand for re-election next year. Thank you.
Honestly, I don't hear, I didn't hear this criticism of Norway. I didn't hear anything. And anyway, let's be honest. My oath of office is that I don't get instruction from any individual government. I get my instruction from the conference or from the council. If there is a collective view of the conference or the council on the way I manage or direct or do, that I obey. And that's important for me. There are 192 countries in FAO, and naturally each of them may have its right of opinion. But that doesn't commit me. But I'm really surprised because on the contrary, at least from what I know, we are working with Norway in the framework of UN RED, which is the joint program we have on deforestation and land degradation with UNEP and with UNDP. And to my knowledge, the program is going very well. And by the way, let me also go back to something else. If it was regular program budget is $500 million roughly annually. But in 2009 only, we got a commitment for trust fund, and I insist on the word trust fund, voluntary, of almost $1 billion. I don't think we oblige anyone to give voluntary money. I believe that those who gave the money, they trust FAO. Why would they give the money? So I honestly have difficulty. I've not heard those comments. And as far as I'm concerned, the Norwegian government never brought these comments to my attention because I would have answered. But what a UN institution is, that is universal. Decisions are made by the governing bodies. They're not made by one single country. Now, regarding the fact of knowing if I will be candidate, I answered that question the day I was re-elected for the third term unopposed. I think governments who were not happy with the leadership could have put up candidates. Why didn't they? Why? I ran unopposed. I don't think that a small country like Senegal can bully or influence any country not to put up candidates. Yet not one single country put a candidate against the Director General. And as soon as I was elected, after thanking all those who had shown confidence in me, I said, this is my last mandate. This is my last term of office. And I'm known to be somebody who keeps his word. But I'm also known to be somebody, you know, who doesn't accept any instruction from any country, however great or small it is.
Thank you, Director. Over there at the middle, please.
Okay, Fatah Rahman Al-Ghadi from Attayar newspaper. Actually, we came to notice that the leaders of G8 did not participate in the summit. Do you think that this phenomena of absentees have a negative impact on the deliberations and the outcome of the conference? This is question one. Question two, civil society organization convene a conference preceding and parallel to the summit. And they came with an outcome documents, which have been reflected, I think, today in the plenary session. How do you evaluate this initiative from civil society organization? And are you satisfied about the level of cooperation and collaboration between civil society organization and FAO at the programmatic and field levels? Thank you very much.
You know, first, this is not a G8 summit. This is a summit of 192 countries, almost the whole world. Therefore, I cannot be measuring the result on the absence at head of state level of seven of them who were represented. They were here. Most of them at ministerial level. So the fact that their head of state or government didn't come, which again, I wish they would, doesn't mean that they have not participated in the discussions and the decisions. I think that we have to keep that in mind. You know, this is a universal forum of United Nations to which we call all participants And one of the principles of United Nations that we uphold is it's one country, one vote. We respect every country, irrespective of how big it is, how powerful it is. We discuss in the framework of the United Nations. So I don't think it has affected the outcome for the simple reason that the outcome document, which was negotiated for more than a month, was unanimously approved. Therefore, I cannot say that it has affected in any way the outcome document. Civil society, well, we have always considered that the members of civil society are our partners. Because first, they are in contact with the realities of poor people, of hungry people. They are in contact with difficult humanitarian situations around the world. And they are people of goodwill. But also they are people who can also say whatever they want, which I cannot. I'm elected as head of an intergovernmental organization of the United Nations. Therefore, I have the obligation, you know, to act in a way that also I do not say something that would naturally create problem with a member state. That's my responsibility as head of UN body and even as simple international civil servant. I sincerely think that the NGOs and the civil society have been helpful. And we've worked with them. We supported them in organizing the meeting. They invited me to address their meeting at its opening, which I did. And since I arrived in FAO, every time I have organized a summit in 96 and 2002, they have been fully involved. And I think their role is positive because there are things they can do and say that we cannot do and say, even if we agree with them.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have gone beyond the allocated slot 10 minutes more, but I can accommodate one more question, please. Yes.
Do you think that world leader that didn't give money you asked are more interested in solve financial crisis than food crisis?
Well, I cannot judge their interest or not interest. I have to base what I say on facts. And the facts are that we need $44 billion a year, around 17% of commitment of ODA per year. And we have seen that in the world, $1,340 billion are being spent every year in arms. And you and I, we saw on the radio, on the TV, on the news, that it has been possible to mobilize trillions of dollars in helping to change the negative situations resulting from the crisis. And that's good. I personally think that we need an economy that works. You know, I'm certainly the first to recognize that if we do not improve the world economic situation, you know, everybody will be losers. The number of hungry people increased by 105 million in 1 year because of that. But I'm just thinking that if it has been possible to mobilize those resources at that level, There is a possibility also to give some more focus on the priority constituted by 1 billion hungry people in the world, and by, unfortunately, one baby dying every 6 seconds because of hunger.
Director General, I would like to give you the final word of this conference. Probably would like to say something to the media.
Well, again, to thank you all, because as I said in my opening statement, you're part of this whole process, and your action, what you say, what you communicate, has an impact on the public opinion. Therefore, the fact that you are here, you see the data, you see the elements, you can discuss with people, you can listen to their argument, etc. Well, you know, this is as important as what we say, you know. We in French, I don't know how to translate it in English, but faire c'est bien, mais faire savoir c'est encore mieux. C'est pour cela, this is why I think that your role is vital in raising awareness of public opinion around the world and influencing the decision that those who can change and improve the situation will be making. So I'm grateful to all of you, and I thank you.